Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. Hope you guys are all doing well. And today's episode is going to take us back in time, as often they do, or I guess they all do, don't they? I mean, if you think about it, history podcast, I guess, you know, even yesterday is history. We're going back. What's that quote? It's like, I think it's Eleanor Roosevelt. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. The present is a gift. I think that's what it is. But anyway, in the present, I guess, my present, but will be the past when you guys are listening to it, your present, but my past. How crazy is that? Time is a crazy thing. We are going to be talking about today the first ever self-made female millionaire in the United States, Madam C.J. Walker and her daughter, and the Harlem Renaissance. That is where we're going in this story. And honestly, guys, like, just please buckle up. It's a great, great story. Very inspiring. If you're kind of feeling like you're in a career rut at the moment and just need a little bit of inspo, keep listening. And of course, if you like anything historic, you will love this episode because we are going back in time to a very colorful era in history, the Harlem Renaissance. So yeah, I think without further ado, we just go, right? Let's go there. let's go to there, as TikTok says. Let's go to that place. Anyway, all right, let's go back in time to the Harlem Renaissance. Imagine walking down the streets of Harlem, and for context, Harlem in New York, Upper Manhattan area, if you're familiar with Manhattan. I'm actually sitting not too far from there as we speak. But imagine you're walking down the streets of Harlem on a warm summer evening in the 1920s, so 100-ish years ago. The air is electric with possibility, the hum of conversations, the laughter spilling out from crowded clubs, and the rhythmic tap of shoes on the pavement fill the night. This is a place where dreams are born, where creativity knows no bounds, and where a new voice for Black America is rising. The Harlem Renaissance wasn't just a moment in time, it was a movement, a cultural explosion that swept across the nation. At its core, the Harlem Renaissance was about reclaiming identity. It was about challenging the stereotypes that had long been imposed on the Black community and creating a new, proud, and authentic image of Black life. Harlem became the epicenter of this renaissance, a magnet for artists, writers, musicians, and thinkers, all eager to express their talents and share their stories. And the written word specifically was a powerful tool in the Harlem Renaissance. Authors like Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, and Claude McKay, might have heard these names before, put pen to paper and crafted these rich narratives that spoke directly to the Black experience. Langston Hughes, who's often dubbed the Poet Laureate of Harlem, captured the rhythms of jazz and the spirit of his people in his poetry. And you can listen to this, you can really hear it, in this one poem called The Weary Blues, which goes like this. Droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway, he did a lazy sway, to the tune of those weary blues, with his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues, sway to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues. Coming from a Black man's soul, oh, blues, in a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world, ain't got nobody but myself. I's going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more. I wish that I had died. And far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead. So that was The Weary Blues by Langston Hughes, one of his famous poems, really kind of encapsulates the energy of the time, I suppose. And so that was the written word, that was poetry. But the music of the Harlem Renaissance was the heartbeat of the movement. Jazz and blues, you know, it was really the time for those genres. Harlem's clubs, like the legendary Cotton Club and the Savoy Ballroom, were the places to be during this time. You can imagine Duke Ellington seated at the piano, which I just got chills thinking of that. I love Duke Ellington, and I can't imagine like just being there for that. You know, his fingers just dancing around the keys with the orchestra, symphonies of sounds, and, you know, just that kind of energy. Just, oh my God, I would love to have seen that, heard that rather. But jazz wasn't just music. It was a language. It was a form of expression that resonated deeply within the Black community and beyond. And it spoke of things like joy, of pain, of struggle, of hope. And musicians like Louis Armstrong and Bessie Smith became icons in this movement. The voices and instruments, you know, that they played, telling stories that words alone couldn't capture. And then, so we have, okay, we have poetry, we have music, and then there was the visual art. Harlem Renaissance gave rise to artists like Aaron Douglas and Augusta Savage, who used their work to depict beauty, strength, and history of the African-American experience. And Aaron Douglas specifically was known for his distinctive style that blended African motifs with modernism, created these murals that adorned the walls of libraries, clubs, and homes, each telling stories of Black history and future aspirations. And if you aren't familiar with Douglas's paintings and his style, it was kind of like these very stylized figures in shades of deep purple, deep blue, their silhouettes bold looking against a backdrop of swirling light and shadow. And each figure in his paintings tells a story, each brush stroke a connection to African roots and a vision of a brighter future. But as amazing as these things were, the art, the music, the poetry, you know, that wasn't just what it was all about. The arts was not, you know, the entirety of the Harlem Renaissance. It was a really amazing part of it, but there was also this intellectual awakening going on, you know, which the term Renaissance kind of, you know, gives you that inkling that there was something deeper going on. The movement of the Harlem Renaissance paved the way for what was known as, quote, the New Negro, a term popularized by philosopher Alan Locke. You might have heard of him. The New Negro was assertive, confident, and unafraid to demand equality. And the idea was at the heart of the Harlem Renaissance. It was about redefining what it meant to be Black in America at that time, you know, not as a passive recipient of history, but as an active creator of culture and a powerful voice in society. And there were a bunch of people at the forefront of this movement. W.E.B. Du Bois, co-founder of the NAACP, and Marcus Garvey, with his vision of Pan-Africanism, they were instrumental in this intellectual revival. And they advocated for the upliftment of Black Americans and challenged the, of course, systemic racism that permeated every aspect of life in the U.S. at this time. And their ideas, these people's ideas, fueled the movement, inspiring artists and activists alike to use their talents to push for change. So it wasn't just, okay, we're making these beautiful art forms and poetry and music and in, you know, other like more physical, tangible art. It's like these things are going to mean something. You know, these things are going to push for change. So this was all happening during the Harlem Renaissance, this time of profound social change set the stage for what would come next, the civil rights movements of the 1950s and the 1960s, laying the groundwork for the fight for equality that would define the mid-20th century. The voices that emerged from the Harlem Renaissance spoke not just for their time, but for all time, for generations to come, echoes of resilience, pride, and an unyielding desire for justice. And one of the loudest voices of them all was a woman named Madam C.J. Walker, the woman of the hour, I should say, because she is the subject of today's episode, she defied the odds and became America's first female self-made millionaire. Her story and journey is one of resilience, innovation, and empowerment in a time period where, you know, you can imagine she faced hurdle after hurdle, every possible issue she faced, and still, you know, she had this passion and she made it happen. And it's really such an inspiring story. So definitely keep listening. Let's talk about her story from the beginning. So Madam C.J. Walker was not born Madam C.J. Walker. She was born Sarah Breedlove. That was her name, Sarah Breedlove, on December 23rd, 1867, in Delta, Louisiana. And her story began under very challenging circumstances. Her parents, Owen and Minerva Breedlove, were formerly enslaved, and Sarah was actually the first in her family to be born into freedom. But freedom didn't mean an easy life. Orphaned at the age of 7, Sarah moved in with her sister, and by the age of 14, she was married. Yeah, she got married at the age of 14 to Moses McWilliams to essentially escape an abusive household. So there was a lot of turmoil, a lot going on, and she saw marriage as her way out. And so she got married at 14, and on June 6th, 1885, Sarah gave birth to her daughter, Alelia. Just 2 years after Alelia was born, Moses passed away. So her husband passed away 2 years after she gave birth, and so Sarah packed up Alelia and moved to St. Louis, where she worked as a washerwoman, earning a mere $1.50 a day. But it was in St. Louis that Sarah found hope. She joined the African Methodist Episcopal Church, where she was inspired by strong, independent women that were around her there. And it was during this time, most importantly, while she was in St. Louis, you know, surrounded by all of these strong women, that she became involved in the black hair care industry, which was a very, you know, it was in its infancy at this time. Like, people really didn't know a ton about black hair care. And so she became involved when she moved to St. Louis, which was a major turning point in her life, as we will see. The catalyst for Sarah's venture into the hair care world came from her own personal struggle with hair loss caused by a scalp disorder that she had. Hair care options at this time, like I said, were super limited, especially for black hair, and the harsh chemicals in many products often did more harm than good. And Sarah was determined to find a solution. At this point in time, it was really for her own benefit. Like, she was struggling with this scalp disorder and she wanted to fix that for herself, or at least, you know, make it feel better. Which I can't imagine. Like, I, you know, I've had my share of skin problems with my eczema struggles, but I can't imagine, like, the scalp of it all. Like, that must have been very uncomfortable for her. So she was determined to find a solution. So she kind of messed around, experimented with homemade remedies, and eventually she developed a formula that actually worked. With just $1.25 in her pocket, Sarah began selling her product door to door. Her dedication to customer service and her personal connection to the product quickly won over her customers. And by 1905, she was actually hired as a commission agent by Annie Turnbow Malone, a successful black hair care product entrepreneur. Under Malone's guidance, Sarah moved to Denver, where she married again. She married a man named Charles Joseph Walker, so C.J. Walker, if you guys are kind of gathering where I'm going here, a newspaper advertising salesman. And it was from him that she took the name Madam C.J. Walker and began to build her hair care empire. And the product that kind of kickstarted everything, that started it all for her, was named Madam Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower. As her success blossomed, Madam Walker, otherwise known as Sarah, went beyond selling single products. Eventually, she offered a complete hair care system, which, you know, as you know, just thinking of the beauty space, it's such a no-brainer to, you know, of course, if you have like one product you start out with that kind of, you know, takes off, it's like, no, you have to complete the line. You have to make sure that, you know, in someone's bathroom, they're only using, like, in theory, obviously it's harder, easier said than done, but you would, in theory, create a product for every need. You know, if you're doing, like, for example, like a shampoo and conditioner, then a detangler, then a heat protectant, then, you know, you have all of the things under one umbrella. If you offer everything, theoretically, if someone really loves one product, they might buy all of your products. So, you know, she offered a complete hair care system. Mind you, this was the early 1900s. Like, it's crazy that she was, you know, not crazy, but you know what I mean? It's very impressive. That's the word I'm looking for. Very impressive that she was able to think this, you know, this under this, you know, brain, this marketing brain. So anyway, this system, complete hair care system, was known as the Walker system, and it included a regimen of products and techniques designed to promote healthy hair and scalp. And the system typically involved the Wonderful Hair Grower, which is the flagship product that I told you guys about that treated scalp conditions and promoted hair growth. There was also Glossine, a pressing oil used to smooth hair and protect it during the hot comb process. There was Vegetable Shampoo, which is a gentle shampoo formulated to clean the scalp and hair without stripping away the natural oils. And a Hot Comb, which is a heated comb used to straighten hair, which was a popular style among Black women at the time. And Madam Walker's system was revolutionary, not just because it catered to the specific needs of Black women's hair, which, like I said, this industry was in its infancy. Like, there wasn't a lot of options at the time for Black women, so this was huge. But because it empowered women with tools and knowledge to care for their hair in a way that had previously been unavailable to them, you know, and it's coming from someone who gets it, who has had, you know, issues with her own hair and can speak from this personal angle. So those were the main reasons why she was so successful. Also because she had this marketing brain in her to think like, oh, I'm going to create multiple products. And, you know, she had her heart in it. She wasn't just trying to profit. Like, you know, she really wanted, this came from a place of need for herself. And then she was like, let me share this, you know, and it played a crucial role in shaping the beauty standards within the Black community. But Madam C.J. Walker, like I said, she wasn't just a businesswoman. She was a visionary. She understood the power of branding and marketing long before they even really became words, you know, became business buzzwords. She traveled extensively, even conducting product demonstrations. So she was like really boots on the ground, like showing people, this is how you use my products. And like, here I am. This is me. I created this. Like, you can trust me. So really just ahead of her time. And as profits continued to grow, in 1908, Madam Walker opened a factory and a beauty school in Pittsburgh. And by 1910, when she transferred her business operations to Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company had become wildly successful with profits that were the modern-day equivalent of several million dollars, which is huge. That's all very quick if you think about it. She opened the factory in 1908. Those stats came from 1910, just 2 years later. So she was crushing it. And to mark her success, in her words, Madam Walker stated, quote, "I am a woman who came from the cotton fields of the South. From there, I was promoted to the washtub. From there, I was promoted to the cook kitchen. And from there, I promoted myself into the business of manufacturing hair goods and preparations. I've built my own factory on my own ground." Which, if that doesn't give you chills, like, I just got full on goosebumps. Wow. Okay, so in Indianapolis, the company not only manufactured cosmetics, but also trained sales beauticians. In Indianapolis, where the company was now headquartered, they not only manufactured cosmetics, but also trained sales beauticians. And they were called the, quote, Walker agents, and became well known throughout the U.S. They promoted her philosophy of cleanliness and loveliness as a means of advancing the status of Black women. That was kind of her tagline, cleanliness and loveliness. And these ladies, the Walker agents, many of whom were previously unemployed or underemployed, were given the tools to build their own businesses and achieve financial independence. So you can kind of think of like a Mary Kay consultant or something like that. Like, I, you know, there's various different companies that have a similar structure. And back then it wasn't so MLM-y, if you know what I mean. So her company employed thousands of Black women across the country. So fast forward, and more so in her personal life, in 1913, Madam Walker and Charles divorced, but that didn't stop her from continuing the grind, continuing to work on, you know, something she loved very much, which was her business. She traveled throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, further promoting her business and recruiting international agents to teach her hair care methods. So she wasn't just, you know, keeping this in the U.S. She was, you know, she wanted this to go worldwide. And let's remember Alelia, so Madam Walker's daughter Alelia, while her mom was away traveling, teaching people worldwide how to use her hair care products, she was back home, old enough now to be doing things to further her mom's business, was actually looking into buying property in Harlem, New York. So we're in Harlem now. Remember, we started the story in Harlem. We are in Harlem now because we kind of went back in time a bit to talk about Madam Walker's kind of, you know, rise to creating her brand. But now this is right, you know, on the cusp or right at the beginning of the time period we now know as the Harlem Renaissance.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, you know, they could kind of sense that something was going on. You know, there was something about to pop there. And so Alelia purchased property in Harlem to kind of continue the operations of her mom's brand, not the factory, obviously. You couldn't have a factory in a townhouse, but, you know, this was an important headquarters of sorts for the brand. And so this townhouse was at 108 West 136th Street in Harlem at first, and then 2 years later, they purchased the adjacent townhouse right next door to it at 110 West 136th Street. So they had 108 and 110, and it became the heart of the business, and it was in the heart of Harlem. So in 1916, upon returning from her travels abroad, Madam Walker moved into her new townhouse in Harlem with her daughter, and from there, she would continue to operate her business the way that she always has, you know, being the heart and soul of her brand, really, you know, giving that personal touch to her hair care brand while she left the day-to-day operations of her factory in Indianapolis to someone else. So she was like, I don't need to be there doing that. I want to be right here in Harlem, you know, while all this is going on. Like, I think that this is an important time for me to be here. And so she made a really wise decision doing that. You know, as I've kind of touched on, as you can kind of assume, Madam Walker's time in Harlem had a huge influence that extended far beyond just her hair care brand. Madam Walker used her wealth that she had gained from, you know, kind of going viral with her hair care products and her platform. People really respected her. People knew her name and her face to advocate for social change. She immersed herself in the social and political culture of the Harlem Renaissance. And Madam Walker was a huge player in the formative early years of the movement. She founded philanthropies that included educational scholarships and donations to homes for the elderly, the NAACP, and the National Conference on Lynching, among other organizations focused on improving the lives of Black Americans. She also donated the largest sum of money by an African American towards the construction of an Indianapolis YMCA in 1913. So she used her newfound wealth for so much good during this time. And in 1917, she just kept the ball rolling, being the amazing person that she was. She organized one of the first national meetings of businesswomen in the country. And this one that she created was known as the National Beauty Culturists and Benevolent Association. And essentially, it provided a platform for Black women to come together and talk about business strategies and network and share their experiences. And so she did that. She really did that. She created one of the first, like, this is huge, guys, one of the first national meetings of business women in the country. And think about the time, 1917. You know, this is, it's just crazy. I mean, again, not crazy. It's not crazy. It is very commendable. It is very inspiring. So many words I have to describe this. Like, I just can't believe it, you know, that she did that. So then in 1918, a year later, Madam Walker built herself a mansion, as she should. Honestly, snaps. She built a beautiful Italian-style mansion that she called Villa. Sorry, I studied Italian in college. Villa Livaro, and it was designed by one of the first licensed Black architects in New York, Vertner Tandy. And let me just tell you, if you look up photos of this, it is just the most stunning thing you've ever seen. This iconic piece of property could honestly be a whole podcast episode on its own. It is so rich with history and cultural significance, but I will just kind of tell you, you know, in a one-liner, it showcases the grandeur and elegance typical of the period's most elite homes. This was, again, built 1916, 1918, you know, it was completed in 1918. And this, you know, think about it, this really symbolized not only wealth, but also the achievement of a Black woman in a segregated society. Like, let's not forget the culture, like how things were at the time, the divide that there was. And this woman built this, you know, marvelous home, fully self-made, doing what she felt passionate to do, while also, or I guess what she felt called to do rather, what she was passionate about. But she also donated, gave back, and helped when she could with the movement, with empowering other Black people during this time. So yeah, for Madam C.J. Walker to commission and build such a mansion was truly a testament to her success and a challenge to the racial and gender norms of the time. However, her home was more than just a home for Madam C.J. Walker. This stood as tribute to her journey from a washerwoman to a millionaire entrepreneur. And by choosing to build such a home, like such a mansion in a predominantly white neighborhood, was a statement. You know, she asserted her rightful place in society and demonstrated that Black society members could attain and enjoy the same luxuries as their white counterparts. So this was huge. And practically speaking, Madam C.J. Walker always intended for her home to be more than a private residence. You know, she envisioned it as a gathering place for leaders of the Black community where they could strategize, organize, and plan for the future. And the mansion hosted numerous meetings and social events with prominent figures in the civil rights movement, including some familiar names like W.E.B. Du Bois, mentioned earlier, and Booker T. Washington. And Madam Walker's vision for this mansion that she built for herself to also become, like, you know, open to the community, this cultural hub, really highlighted her commitment to using her wealth and influence to support the advancement of her community. So she just, oh my gosh, she did so much at this time. You know, she really just, everything she got, she gave. But sadly, Madam C.J. Walker's life was cut short when she passed away on May 25th, 1919, at the age of 51, due to complications from hypertension, otherwise known as high blood pressure. But her legacy lives on, and Villa Livaro continues to embody that legacy today. Fun fact, it was actually designated a National Historic Landmark in 1976, and the preservation of the mansion ensures that future generations can appreciate and learn from Madam C.J. Walker's remarkable achievements, and it serves as this physical reminder of what she gave to American history and the ongoing struggle for racial equality and economic empowerment. Alelia, let's not forget her, Alelia Walker, made sure that her legacy lived on as well. Alelia inherited the mansion, of course, and maintained it as a center for the Harlem Renaissance. She hosted artists, musicians, and writers who were pivotal in shaping African-American culture. And after her mother's death, the mansion became even more of a symbol of Black empowerment during a time when Black culture was flourishing in New York and beyond. And it became very clear very quickly that Alelia wasn't just the daughter of this business mogul. She was a cultural icon in her own right. And so our story shifts to the daughter. Like mother, like daughter, we're going to talk about Alelia. So as we know, Alelia's early life was marked by her mother's determination and entrepreneurial spirit. Entrepreneurial, I can never say that. After moving to St. Louis and later to Denver, Alelia watched as her mom built this thriving business, manufacturing and selling hair care products specifically designed for Black women. Alelia was educated in the best schools her mom could afford, and after graduating, she joined her mother in the business, helping to manage the growing empire. But Alelia's interests extended far beyond business. You know, she obviously loved supporting her mom, but she had a passion for the arts and a deep love for literature, music, and culture, which of course is right in line with the Harlem Renaissance and all of those things we discussed earlier. And so it was actually kind of Alelia's idea to make this mansion that her mother built into this cultural hub space, not just a meeting space, like having, you know, all of the arts kind of collide into this home and, you know, things like that. So after her mom's death in 1919, Alelia inherited, of course, the Walker Empire and continued to run the business, but her true passion lay in fostering the arts. She had this townhouse on 136th Street that was known as the Dark Tower, and it became legendary for the gatherings she hosted. For a long time, Alelia had been hosting salons and parties and dinners in this townhouse, and in late 1924, she began renting out space on the second floor for private parties and meetings, calling the space the Walker Studio, after her mom and her family. In 1927, Alelia hired designer Paul T. Frankel to redecorate the Walker Studio, and one element that he added to the space was a custom-designed skyscraper bookcase named for its architectural characteristics. And in October of 1927, the Dark Tower, envisioned as this private membership club, very Soho House, inspired by the skyscraper bookcase, officially opened in a room within the Walker Studio, which had now expanded to the second and third floors of the townhouse. And Frankel's skyscraper bookcase became its logo of sorts, appearing on the Dark Tower's stationery and invitations. So she really created, like her mother, a brand with, you know, the Renaissance being at the forefront, and like all of the attributes, the music, the poetry, the art. So the Dark Tower, this social club that Alelia created, became a symbol of the Harlem Renaissance, a place where art and social change converged, like I said. And, you know, to think about it, you can imagine this room filled with, you know, people like Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, County Cullen, and Duke Ellington, all exchanging ideas, performing and celebrating Black culture. And Alelia Walker, one thing about her is she had this amazing taste. And this was often seen reflected in her hosting style at the Dark Tower. She was often seen adorned in the finest gowns with her hair styled in the latest fashions, probably making her mom so proud. And her presence was magnetic, and she was affectionately dubbed the Joy Goddess of Harlem by none other than Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes. Imagine Langston Hughes, this, you know, famous poet, giving you a name like the Joy Goddess of Harlem. Like, that's, you know, that means you're pretty great, I'd assume. And in Langston Hughes' autobiography, he actually included a section about Alelia Walker and her parties. He said, Alelia Walker had a space that held perhaps 100 people. She would usually issue several hundred invitations to each party. Unless you went early, there was no possible way of getting in. Her parties were as crowded as the New York subways at the rush hour, entrance, lobby, steps, hallway, and apartment, a milling crush of guests, with everybody seeming to enjoy the crowding. And so she had these parties, these gatherings where, you know, culture kind of exploded in here. Like, there was people with all different interests just kind of exploding, coming together, collaborating, all of that, which was great. So she was doing that, but she was also, like her mother, giving back. She was a patron of the arts. She used her wealth to support Black artists via the Dark Tower Club. She provided financial assistance and a platform for many emerging talents, helping them to launch their careers that might otherwise have been stifled by the racial prejudices of that time. And her support was critical in fostering an environment where Black creativity could thrive. Despite her glamorous lifestyle, you know, wearing all these gowns and her hair always perfectly done, Alelia's life was not without its challenges. She faced the pressures of running a business empire during a time when Black women were rarely seen in positions of power. She also navigated the complexities of maintaining her mom's legacy while forging her own path in the world. Like, it must have been hard to potentially feel like you're living in your mother's shadow, you know, and she's also gone now, so you can't even really ask her for advice. Like, it must have been challenging for her. But in many ways, Alelia's life was a balancing act between business and pleasure, tradition and innovation. Also, disappointingly, 1 year after opening in October of 1928, the Dark Tower closed. Yeah, I know. I was so excited about that Dark Tower Social Club. But yeah, after a year it closed because she'd begun charging for food and refreshments. So she was, you know, charging money because she couldn't, you know, fund it forever. She wanted it to kind of, you know, get off the ground. Like, she would help it get off the ground and then it would kind of float on its own, right? But she started charging for food and refreshments, which was a hard adjustment for a lot of people to make. And so she still continued to rent the townhouse out for events, but then, in 1929, the market crashed, and fewer parties were obviously thrown during the Depression. So, yeah, things kind of came to a screeching halt with the Depression, and then tragically, Alelia Walker passed away suddenly, and at a relatively young age, like her mom. On August 17th, 1931, at the age of just 46 years old, Alelia died from a cerebral hemorrhage. And her death marked the end of an era, but her influence in the Harlem Renaissance and on Black culture in America was profound. Like, if you think about the sheer number of people that crossed, you know, through her threshold, through her door, and met and collaborated at these parties, like so many things that we know today, like the legendary jazz music, so many things that we know that came out of the Harlem Renaissance, that came out of the early 1900s, were because of things like this, these meetings that Alelia held, the funding that was made possible because of her mother's dream to create this hair care brand. Like, these two women really did so much. And we are still seeing the aftershocks of that today, even though they both had tragically rather short lives. You may be wondering, though, whatever happened to the Dark Tower after Alelia's death. We know that it kind of went out of business and then the Depression happened. Well, after she passed away and after the Depression had kind of run its course, the townhouse was rented out to the city of New York, which used the space for a health clinic. And then in 1941, so health clinic, great thing, helps a lot of people. Then in 1941, the townhouse was demolished, which sounds kind of sad if you think about it. But then we have to remember, though, that it was taken over by the New York Public Library, and they built one of their branches there, which is called the County Cullen Branch. And this library today gives Harlem residents of all ages access to library services delivered in a friendly and effective manner. That's what their website says. But yeah, it became a library, which I think is just so amazing. Like, the transition from this place where so many creative minds came together to then a place where more creative minds can learn. You know, it's just, I think it's a good evolution, metamorphosis of sorts. But the Dark Tower lives on. And according to one of my sources, it's in the imagination of anyone who knows or reads anything about the Harlem Renaissance. It was the place that everybody wanted to be. It was where people hosted their most special events. Everyone wanted to say that they had been to the Dark Tower. As we look back on the life of the Walker women, Alelia and Sarah, we see entrepreneurs, catalysts for change, and supporters of the arts, beacons of joy in a time of great transformation, and also, you know, great pain. Like, there was a lot of pain, a lot of hardship going on during this time period, and they were beacons of hope and joy. And the Harlem Renaissance would not have been the same without their contributions. And for that, they remain an enduring figure in the story of Black cultural history. And not only that, they are a testament to the tenacity and determination of women, even during this time when women, Black women, most importantly, were not given the opportunity that they should have been. But they didn't seem to care about that. They were like, you know what, your, you know, societal norms, we don't care about that. We are going to do what we want to do, what we need to do, and that's that. You know, so if you're ever doubting your abilities, or if you're questioning a pivot in your life, like a career change or something of that nature, remember the Walker women, especially Madam C.J. Walker. She did so much. She was the first self-made female millionaire in the United States. Don't forget it. Let these final words of hers, actually, we're going to bring in some of her words here, echo in your head during those times of self-doubt. She said, quote, "I had to make my own living and my own opportunity, but I made it. Don't sit down and wait for the opportunities to come. Get up and make them," end quote. And guys, that is the story of Madam C.J. Walker and Alelia Walker. I hope you guys enjoyed this story and it made you feel something, maybe you just learned something new. And over on our Instagram, Found Objects Podcast, I'm going to post some photos of her hair care line, of both of the women, of just notable moments from their lives. So definitely check it out if you guys want a visual reference to go with this. And as always, guys, thank you so much for listening. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.